Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
All righty. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So our guest today, I got to tell you, he's quite the rock star. I mean, he's done it multiple times. You know, we're talking about eight times, and eight times in a very small time frame. You know, we're talking about like maybe like a little bit over a decade. One of them actually, you know, he took public. You know, right now he's trading at about 1.2 billion plus market cap. But the incredible journey, you know, we're going to be talking about how, you know, he went, you know, about clinical trials with one of his companies, the first one. Also thinking about acquisition versus staying private. Also the incubator, you know, program that he is pushing, you know, which has had remarkable success with the companies collectively raising over 300 million. And then also a new company that is launching. So again, building, scaling, financing, and exiting, all the above that we like to hear. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, David Schaefer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Alejandro. Thrilled to be here.
So originally born in Latin America, you know, out of, you know, a meetup, you know, that your parents had in grad school. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
Sure. I actually don't remember, unfortunately, being in Latin America. I lived there all of 6 months before my parents decided to move back up to the U.S. But yeah, my father was an academic. My mother did drug development for her career, worked in a couple of different pharmaceutical companies. But, you know, grew up pretty much like any other kid all the way through high school, and then went to college at Stanford University, which, you know, ironically is Berkeley's rival these days. So, but after finishing up at Stanford, moved to MIT for graduate school, Salk Institute for a postdoc, and came up to UC Berkeley in 1999 to start up my academic career, and have been here ever since for 25 years. So most definitely my home.
So what got you into engineering out of all things? Why engineering?
It was, you know, motivated in part by my parents. My father was a very, very basic biologist within academia, a professor. So extremely basic, not application oriented. And my mother was on the kind of the opposite end of the spectrum. She was an MD, a physician who did drug development and ran everything from phase one to phase four clinical trials in her role at Novartis and then at Sanofi. I wanted to be somewhere in between. I wanted to be more applied than my father was. I liked making things, but I also, you know, enjoyed this idea of being able to pursue things of interest to me, you know, academic freedom. So that made me an engineer and an academia. So I figured out pretty early on that that's what I wanted to do for my career. And thankfully it worked out.
So out of all things, you know, like you said, you know, academia. So, I mean, academia, you know, it's a really interesting route that you decided to pursue, especially, you know, given the fact that you're also a serial entrepreneur. So how do you think, you know, that balance, you know, between the two, you know, have shaping up for you?
One of the reasons I really like academia is that it's design your own career. In some cases, people decide to really focus on the research programs they're building within their labs, which I've done for, you know, much of my career. People can decide to focus on teaching. They can decide to become a chair, a dean, a provost, a chancellor, which I never, you know, that was not my interest. People can play a role in translating their technologies from their academic labs into industry. And at different times of my career, I've had different interests in that spectrum. But really, you know, roughly for the first half of my career, I was really focused on building up my academic program and our research and working on solving what I found to be some interesting problems. And the second half of my career so far, I've been focused on taking the results of that work and translating it from the public sector into the private sector and getting it into companies that can then advance it to human clinical development. But academic freedom affords you the ability to do all of the above. So I very much enjoyed it.
No kidding. Now, obviously for you, you ended up in kind of like establishing your own incubator, you know, or I would say like system to really just like span out, you know, companies out of it. So how did this come about? Because I mean, out of this, obviously, you know, like your biggest success to date, you know, came out, which is for the molecular therapeutics, which you ended up taking public. But How did the whole concept and structure for this, you know, come together?
It was, you know, as I mentioned, I developed a really strong interest in getting our technology from an academic lab into a company. And that was motivated, you know, and by and large by my experiences with, you know, learning from how my mother worked, that companies are the entities that take basic research and advance them into clinical development and eventually into products that can be scaled to really help society. So I always knew I wanted to play a role in forming companies and started doing that, you know, as you mentioned, about a decade ago, 10, 11 years ago or so, and learned through each one of those companies that I've co-founded a lot, a huge amount. We did some things right. You know, I made some mistakes. And, you know, once you learn a few mistakes, you know, fortunately, none of them are fatal. All of 8 of my companies, well, the 2 have been acquired, no longer exist. The other 6 do. But, you know, I felt that I wanted to, you know, in addition to doing research, be an educator, because that's the heart of academia, education and research. And so I had the opportunity starting around 3 years ago or so to take the leadership role of an organization, a multi-UC campus organization called QB3, which is focused on scientific innovation and entrepreneurship. QB3, you know, back in around 2006, formed the very first incubator in the University of California system at UCSF. 2008 formed the very first university-affiliated venture capital fund anywhere in the country. So our organization has had a long-standing history of being innovative at that interface between academia and companies. So I became the overall director around 3 years ago. We opened up what's now the largest university owned and operated by a technology incubator in the country called Baker Labs, which is a partnership between QB3, University of California, Berkeley, and a terrifically generous donor foundation. And Baker Labs is 95,000 square feet. We're home to 31 companies. As you mentioned, those companies have collectively raised $390 million, have created 350 jobs in the state of California. And, you know, fortunately for me as well, I've been a terrific home to 2 of my own companies as we spun them out of the university and then enabled them to grow and in one case move on and outgrow the incubator.
So obviously, you know, in total, you've launched 8 companies, you know, and you even have your own, you know, umbrella, you know, where you would you just like spin out companies yourself. So what ended up being that framework, you know, from the way that you think about an idea to the way that you think about bringing it to life to the way that you perhaps, you know, like plug in the right team and then finance it and let it grow and fly?
Sure. It always started, of course, with the idea. And I wasn't necessarily looking for ideas to build companies around, you know, during the first 10, 15 years of my career. I was looking for big problems, you know, things that I, you know, my engineering, you know, side of my brain felt was a big problem that really deserved a solution, deserved a technology to solve the problem. So I started working on problems in gene and cell therapy, began to publish on each of them, patent them, et cetera. And at some point, a solution to a problem reached a critical mass where it could be the basis of a company. You know, even though I didn't really intend to start spinning companies out of my lab, I was just interested in solving problems. But if you put together a, you know, a compelling technological solution to an important biomedical problem that has publications and patents around it, that becomes a great package for starting a company. So started doing that around 2012 or so, and you know, kind of caught the bug. It's something that I found to be fascinating. Each one of those companies is very different from each other and had a different kind of organic growth path. But you know, roughly, we've started companies when we hit that critical mass of having, you know, IP and technology that addresses an important biomedical need. Then I've typically started it by, you know, onboarding or bringing on board a graduate student or postdoc who was involved in creating the technology. These folks are really smart. I've known them for, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 years, meaning I have a lot of trust and a lot of confidence in them. And there are folks who will move mountains to make the technology work. You know, if they originally played a role in inventing it. But I've also typically paired them together with more experienced leadership as time has gone on to mentor and enable those people to grow. And then, of course, the traditional process of pitching VCs, raising funds. In many cases, we've actually also done it non-dilutively through BD partnerships with larger companies. And each one of those companies has launched with, in some cases, a huge amount of my time invested. In other cases, I'm more of a consultant and board member, but I like to continue to stay involved with each one of them and have the joy of watching them grow.
That's amazing. So then let's talk about the first one, your first baby and an amazing success, which was 4D Molecular Therapeutics. So obviously, you guys got started with this, and that was back in 2012. So what was really the concept? What ended up becoming the company and really the business?
Sure. It was technically 4D was my second company. My first company I started in 2012. I wasn't as actively involved in that. It was myself and another professor, and he ended up playing a bigger role within that company. 4D was based on technology that I started inventing in my lab back in 1999. And my doing that work was really taking on three leaps of faith that all did end up working out. The first is that gene therapy was going to work and was going to be an important therapeutic modality. And gene therapy, of course, is the idea that you can use DNA as a medicine, that if somebody has a broken gene, such as cystic fibrosis or hemophilia, you could deliver the correct version of that gene and as a result, potentially treat the disease. That's an oversimplification, and there are other ways that gene therapy can be used, but to a good extent, it's about delivering correct copies of broken genes. So in addition, it's really hard to deliver DNA. Most of the time the body thinks that DNA is a bad thing. We associate it with viruses and bacteria, foreign DNA. But you can use viruses and take away their ability to replicate and trick them into delivering a piece of medicinal DNA rather than their own DNA. And there was one particular virus I've been working with for almost 30 years called adeno-associated virus. And my second leap of faith was that was going to be the one. That was going to be a virus that the field was going to succeed in using. And the third was that natural versions of this virus weren't going to be good enough. And we felt that we needed to engineer much more efficient targeted versions of this virus. It's a respiratory virus, not a very good one. And when you start showing its cells outside of the lung, show it a neuron or a heart cell or a muscle cell, the virus says, what is this? Evolution has not prepared me throughout tens of millions of years to be able to infect and deliver DNA to the cell successfully. So we invented a technology that enabled us to reprogram these viruses and make them much better at carrying that DNA to a variety of cells and tissues throughout the body. I basically adapted a protein engineering approach called directed evolution that was emerging in the field at the time and actually went on to win the Nobel Prize in 2018. And we were the first to use that with AAV and with gene therapy. So fast forward to 2013, the technology was ripe, gene therapy was starting to work, and the capital markets were in good shape. So that was the time to spin out that technology into 4D.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. There's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So With that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com, and we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So let's talk about then 4D2, I mean, the way that you guys were able to take it all the way to IPO. I mean, what was that like? I mean, sounds like a wild, you know, journey.
In 2013, gene therapy was starting to work. I mean, as you well know, 2008 was a huge disruption to the world and to the capital markets. And a lot of capital was sitting on the sidelines for a few years. And then right around 2012 or 2013, the capital markets started recovering. People were looking for things to invest in. And biotech became a big one. And there were three real major areas where investors started coming into biotech. It was in cancer immunotherapy, genome editing, and gene therapy. So gene therapy, which was really a backwater of medicine for a couple of decades, all of a sudden came to the fore, and there was a huge amount of interest in it. So at that time, people were coming to me because we had been publishing for 10 years about this new technology to be able to engineer versions of this virus, AAV, at will, and optimize them for delivery in the eye or in the lung or in the brain or to muscle. So we had this strong track record, and people were coming to me, which was, again, kind of a change from what I was used to. So there were both investors as well as larger companies that were trying to launch their own gene therapy programs and needed delivery vehicles. So we spun our company out, 4D. I co-founded it with a Berkeley alum by the name of David Kern, who's currently the CEO. So David and I spun out 4D along with a graduate student from my lab. Melissa Cotterman is her name. She's been terrifically successful. And we decided to finance the company not through the traditional VC route initially, but through business development partnerships, because there were companies coming to me asking for, you know, can we get access to your novel viruses? So we made a couple of deals, used that capital initially to grow the company, and then started doing, you know, we did a Series A and Series B, Series C. We had a couple of offers for acquisition during that time as well. But I felt really that, you know, at that stage, gene therapy was relatively new within industry. And there weren't a lot of large partner companies that really knew how to do it. So, you know, part of the reason or part of the rationale for being acquired by a larger company is to achieve synergies, that they know things that you don't, and they have capabilities that you don't. And we kind of felt that since gene therapy was so new within industry, that we, you know, potentially could become the big company that was doing that kind of work. And so we decided to stay private throughout. And then in December of 2020, ultimately, you know, took the plunge and decided to go public. So it was myself, the CEO, and the chairman of the board who did the all the TTW meetings and the IPO roadshow. I probably wouldn't have, you know, because the old way of doing IPOs, of course, was through trains, you know, planes, trains, and automobiles, packing a week or more with tons of meetings with investors and hopping on the plane and you know, nonstop. This was, of course, in the middle of COVID, so people had the luxury of being able to do IPOs from the comfort of their own bedrooms, which is exactly what I did back then. And so I had, you know, 75 investor meetings over the course of a couple of months, and it ended up being a pretty successful IPO, 21x subscribed. Goldman Sachs was our lead bank, B of A, the second bank. And you know, the important part of going public, of course, is that the company then had the capital to be able to do what we were all enthusiastic about, which is get the technology further into clinical development where we can start helping patients.
So I guess, you know, in this case, I mean, incredible, right? You know, like being able to build a company that, you know, is worth more than $1.2 billion. No, I think that this was just like part of, you know, continuing to push also more companies. I mean, in total eight, you know, that you've done. The second one, you know, which also, you know, went through a liquidity event, you know, was basically Rewrite. Now in Rewrite, you know, it was pretty much like 3 years in when you guys decided to go through an M&A transaction. I guess, you know, the question here, you know, is what were you guys doing there and why did you decide to get the company acquired versus staying private and growing it?
Yeah, it was every company, of course, is its own unique thing. And the right, you know, quote unquote, right decision is different for each one. So I'll give you a little bit of background about Rewrite. So it was a genome editing company. It was really the brainchild of a brilliant graduate student of mine named Shaked Halperin, where he and I and another investigator published a paper in Nature back in 2018. And the company was based on that technology. And it was a way to very efficiently do genome editing and change a stretch of DNA inside of a cell and overcome a couple of hurdles to really improve the efficiency of that process. And so the field as a whole is pretty familiar with this word CRISPR now, right? So CRISPR was a technology that was originally published in 2012 by Jennifer Doudna, who's a professor as well at University of California at Berkeley, where I work. And so Jennifer and I are colleagues. We've published together. And Shaked, you know, published this terrific paper that ended up being the basis for Rewrite, which was spun out of Berkeley with Shaked as the CEO. So we were developing this genome editing technology and were in a discussion about a partnership, a BD deal. And as sometimes happens, that BD deal ended up morphing into an M&A discussion. And this was with Intellia. Intellia is a larger public genome editing company. And it made sense for Rewrite to talk to Intellia about M&A in that we had the core of what I thought was fantastic technology for genome editing, but there are a couple of other pieces you need in order to grow independently as a company. We needed delivery because we had a genetic cargo to be able to fix a broken gene. We hadn't worked on the delivery for it. And there's this other delivery technology, lipid nanoparticles, which Intellia had working very well, especially for one target organ, the liver. And in addition, you know, at 4D, we built the clinical infrastructure, you know, the regulatory GMP manufacturing and ClinOps capability. That was going to be a big build that we had ahead of us at Rewrite. Intellia already had that because they were already in the clinic at the time. So they were interested, though, in early stage technologies to be able to improve their genome editing capability. So this ended up being really strong complementarity between their large company and our, at that time, you know, 2 to 3 year spin-out company. And we're able to come to terms that everybody was happy with. And so it really made sense to get acquired in that case. And I'm thrilled that, as Intellia has mentioned in a couple of public communications, they've continued to diligently advance the technology forward. And I'm looking forward to the day where they take it into the clinic.
And this is just one of, you know, many that you've done, because, I mean, another one that you also started and that ended up getting acquired, that was Ignite Immunotherapies, and that was acquired by Pfizer. So I guess, what were you guys doing there at Ignite? And I mean, now here we're talking about Pfizer. And by the way, for the people that are listening, you know, just to close the gap on Rewrite, you know, it was acquired for $45 million upfront and then $155 million in milestones. But now moving to Ignite, you know, what were you guys doing there? And obviously Pfizer, you know, a massive company. I mean, how is perhaps different, you know, the M&A process with a company like that?
Yeah, that one is very different in the sense that Pfizer made the initial investment and there was, you know, the possibility that they would ultimately be the acquirer of the company. So, you know, we had a, you know, it was fully an option to keep the company independent and continue to grow. But we were almost hoping that Pfizer might become a long-term partner or potentially an acquirer. It was a cancer therapy company, and cancer therapeutics takes large amounts of time, lots of clinical expertise, and enormous amounts of capital to be able to advance into the clinic and ultimately to get a regulatory approval. So in that case, you know, having a partner with tons of expertise and deep pockets like Pfizer was really an asset to Ignite Immunotherapies. So the technology behind the company is that I mentioned to you that we had been working with AAV gene therapy, and that became the basis for 4D. And we invented this new way of engineering viruses. Maybe I'll take a second or two to talk about the technology. So we all know from COVID, right, that viruses evolve in nature. and we had to keep taking, you know, vaccines, stay one step ahead of viral evolution. Usually that's a bad process, you know, enables viruses to continuously adapt so they can escape our immune systems, et cetera. We began to turn that on its head and actually use viral evolution as a good thing. So specifically, you know, we're using these viruses as delivery vehicles to carry DNA medicine inside of a cell, but they haven't been prepared by evolution to be able to infect some really important cell types. Like AAV, I mentioned, is a respiratory virus. You know, it's not really great at infecting the brain or the heart or the retina. So what we began to do is evolve AAV, but in the laboratory and artificially. So we created a billion different versions of AAV with changes within the structural proteins of the virus that mediate the delivery. And then we perform a high throughput selection so that we can identify the one variant that excels at the brain or at the heart or at the liver, et cetera. And then this variant, this new engineered variant, often ends up being 10 or 100 or 1,000 fold better than the natural version of the virus at getting into that tissue. And that then becomes our clinical candidate that we would advance into a phase one trial. So we did that for 4D using this harmless virus called AAV. Most of us have been infected with it, never even noticed it because it's harmless. It's very quiet, doesn't cause human disease. So with Ignite Immunotherapies, we wanted to do the same thing and engineer a virus. But in this case, it was a very different virus. It was vaccinia. And vaccinia is a virus that replicates and typically kills a cell. So why would you want to do that? Well, if you could engineer a version of vaccinia that replicated and selectively killed a cell inside of a tumor, this could be an immunotherapy, the basis of a therapeutic for cancer. So we implemented for the first time the idea of evolving vaccinia or creating new versions of vaccinia that would excel at being able to replicate within a tumor. That became the basis of the lead technology, and Pfizer acquired that so they could further develop it for clinical application.
So then for this, I mean, obviously, incredible exit tool. Now it sounds like, you know, you have a bunch of companies, you know, that you're operating in parallel, you know, spanning from seed to like series A, B. And it sounds like you're also in the process of rolling out something new. So what can you tell us about this new company that we're probably going to be hearing about soon?
Sure. So I have five companies right now. Like you mentioned, the youngest is a pre-seed company. And the most senior is a Series B company. Series B was led by Morningside. A company right now that we're raising for is a stem cell company. So the majority of companies that I've worked on have been gene delivery companies, and this is a cell therapy company. And the idea or the difference between those two is that in the case of gene therapy, you're typically delivering a piece of DNA to be able to improve or rescue the function of a cell. If it's a situation where a disease has killed off a lot of a tissue, killed off a lot of cells, then gene delivery isn't going to do it. You actually need to rebuild the tissue. You need to deliver cells to repopulate and rebuild the tissue. So a stem cell is an incredibly valuable source of cells because a stem cell can divide in an immature state for a long time, and then you can coax it into differentiating or specializing into a particular cell type. And then you can implant that cell into the body, into a place where the tissue has been depleted due to a disease. So as an example, by the time that somebody ends up with Parkinson's disease, they've typically lost somewhere around 50 to 80% of the cells within that region of the brain called the striatum. So we need to rebuild that tissue. And so we've been differentiating stem cells into the type of neuron that's lost in Parkinson's disease. And then you can implant those cells into the brain and be able to repair the brain from the effects of Parkinson's. So we've been working on a couple of disease targets like that, such as Parkinson's disease, epilepsy, as well as type 1 diabetes, and growing the company, building the team around this technology, and at the same time pursuing both, you know, equity financing as well as potentially BD relationships to enable the company to further grow.
So obviously, you know, incredible, you know, journey, incredible experience that you've had over the past 12 years, you know, building, scaling, financing, exiting companies. If I was to put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time and bring you back in time to that point where maybe in 2012, you were thinking about, you know, starting the journey of being a founder. And let's say you have the opportunity of having a chat with that younger David and you're able to give that younger David one piece of advice before launching a company. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Yeah, I'll say first off that younger David was pretty clueless at the time about starting companies. In that, you know, it was a very, very different world from what I was used to. Probably the advice I would give is, you know, it's the same advice I would give to young Professor David back in 1999, which is to spend more time talking with people and meeting with people and networking with people. In that, you know, well, I'm a fan of Warren Buffett, and Warren Buffett has this saying that he likes to surround himself with people who are better than he is, and then he naturally drifts in their direction. So I probably didn't spend as much time as I should talking to smart, successful people out there and learning from them, learning what their secrets are. I, you know, granted that as a professor in Berkeley, I didn't have access to the kind of network that I have now, but I would have been more proactive in reaching out and talking with people and getting on their calendar, taking them out for coffee or a beer and learning from them. Because I think that, you know, as I mentioned, none of my mistakes have been fatal. You know, all eight companies that I've started are still, well, the two that acquired don't exist, but the other six do. But I think I could have saved myself or spared myself the fate of making a couple of key mistakes if I'd learned from other people. And that's really, you know, to come full circle, what I've been trying to do with our incubator is to spare my colleagues the fate of making the same mistakes that I did.
So, David, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Sure. I'm easy to find on the internet. You know, David Schaefer, Berkeley. Email address is schaefer@berkeley.edu. I respond to emails nonstop and love talking to new people and learning from them and hopefully sharing a thing or two that I may have learned that's, you know, could benefit their future. So more than happy to talk, especially if you have a NewCo and would love to become part of a thriving ecosystem that we've been building here. In our incubator called Baker Labs.
Amazing. Well, hey, David, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
It's been an honor to be here. Thank you so much, Alejandro.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.